Everybody likes a good controversy, don't they? Especially ad agencies. Take a look at this recruitment ad from McDonald's. We don't hire Turks, Greeks, Poles, Indians, Ethiopians, Vietnamese, Chinese or Peruvians. The small print reads, nor Swedes, South Koreans or Norwegians. We hire individuals. We don't care what your surname is, because ambition and determination have nothing to do with your nationality. It's an advert from McDonald's Sweden. Immigration's perhaps the political hot potato at the moment, isn't it? It led in large part to the Brexit vote and also to the election of Donald Trump in America. So it's perhaps no surprise that marketing agencies are finding ways of exploiting that attitude. However, as controversial as immigration might be these days, it's not got anything on the most controversial line in our reading this morning. Did you spot it? In verse 22, Jesus said, "This is my body." Four little words who have caused all untold arguments. Books written about them, blood has been spilt over the meaning of those four words. I wonder what you think they mean. I repeat them every time we have a communion service. I wonder what you think they mean. Well, today we're going to think about it using three R's. Not the three R's you know. Rescue, responsibility, and gratitude. I couldn't think of an R for gratitude, but it's got an R in it, so there we go. The three R's. There are a few red herrings in today's passage that we need to sort of name and shame as we begin. The first is the date that all this took place. Scholars have expended much ink on whether Mark was wrong or whether John was wrong or who or whether how you can sort of rationalise it all together. There's stuff to do with the way Jews counted days as starting on the evening instead of at midnight like we do. There's all sorts of stuff like that. The second red herring is how Jesus knew about the room. Because apparently it's very unusual for a man to be carrying a water jar. That was one of the jobs that women did. When men carried water, they used a leather skin. So the fact that the man was carrying a water jar suggests a prearranged arrangement that Jesus had made. But the way Mark says it, it sort of sounds like it was supernatural knowledge. Well, that's a bit of a red herring as well. We're going to forget about that one. And the third red herring, believe it or not, is how many people were in the upper room. You might think there were 13. Well, the word in verse 15 for a large room upstairs, the word is mega. It means big. So some people reckon there were loads of people up there. But of course, they're not mentioned by Mark, so we're going to forget all of them as well. If you want to know about them, I've got plenty of books that will waste a lot of time. It's important to ask questions and to find out exactly what's going on in the text, as long as we don't miss the wood for the trees. And the wood, in this particular case, Mark's main point is that this was taking place during the Passover. He says it four times. Verse 12, we have Passover lamb. Verse 12, we have eat the Passover. Verse 14, we have eat the Passover again. And verse 16, we have prepared the Passover. Now, as Ray said last week, Mark is a man of few words. So when he repeats one four times, perhaps we need to sit up and listen. He's saying Passover, 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 Passover. He wants us to know this is happening during the Passover. You got the message? Fantastic. All the way back in the book of Exodus, so that's all the way back there, right in the beginning of the Bible, something like 1,500 years before Jesus was born, God's people were slaves in Egypt. And they cried out to him for help, and so he sent Moses and Aaron to go and lead them out of Israel to freedom in the promised land, to deliver them from the king of Egypt, or Pharaoh. But Pharaoh was stubborn. And so God had to send the famous 10 plagues. There they all are. Little diagrams. Plagues to ruin Egypt as punishment for the way they treated the Israelites. Now, each time, Pharaoh had the opportunity to avoid the plague and let the people go. But because of his pride and stubbornness, he kept resisting. After the seventh plague, which you'll see down there, it's the one with the flame, the hail and the fire, Pharaoh's own advisors said to him in Exodus 10 verse 7, "Do you not yet realize that Egypt is ruined?" And yet he still didn't let them go. It wasn't until the final plague, down there at the bottom right, the 10th and final plague, that Pharaoh finally allowed the Israelites to leave. The firstborn male, from Pharaoh's son to the son of the lowest slave, even including the cattle, would be killed. All Pharaoh had to do to avoid that was let the people go. But he didn't. And so that night, Moses commanded the Israelites to kill a lamb, a one-year-old lamb without blemish, to roast it over a fire, make unleavened bread, that's bread without yeast, because they didn't have time to let it rise. But more importantly, they were to take some of the blood from the lamb and paint it on their doorposts. Why? Verse 13 in Exodus 12, "The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you." That's why it's called the Passover. The blood of those lambs identified God's people and saved them from death. And through that, they were rescued from slavery. And so for centuries, the Jewish people have celebrated the Passover, in which they look back to that night and they say, "We are them. And they are us. We are the people who were rescued." And so it's no coincidence that Jesus was killed at the Passover. At the exact time, in fact, that the Passover lambs were being slaughtered across Israel. To put it crudely, Jesus is the ultimate Passover lamb, sacrificed once and for all, and whose blood both identifies and rescues God's people from slavery and death. There was a vicar, not this one, who was once in the middle of his sermon, and he beckoned over to the church warden and said to her, "That man in the third row is asleep. Go and wake him up." And she responded, "You put him to sleep, you wake him up." We have here another one of those Marken sandwiches. Again, Ray said last week, the bit in the middle of the sandwich doesn't have to be meat. So here is a nut burger, or a bean burger, whatever it is. I'm not quite sure what the bits in it are, but there you go. It's a vegetarian sandwich. And today, the sandwich filling is about responsibility. We have Passover at the beginning, we have Passover at the end, and in the middle we have this little bit about responsibility. Jesus and his disciples in verse 15 arrived in the large room. Verse 17. They arrived in that large room. It was furnished with plush carpets and somewhere they could recline for their fancy meal. This was no ordinary meal. It was a fancy meal. But it was the kind of intimate meal that you would share with close friends or family. You know, the sort of meal where you're all crowded into a room and you spend half the meal passing stuff from one side of the table to the other. You know that sort of meal? Some of you do. People in the third row asleep? But all was not well. Jesus had spent the last 3 years traveling and eating and sailing and fishing and teaching these 12 men. And now one of them was about to betray him. "Truly I tell you," he said in verse 18, "one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me." They were saddened, and one by one they said to him, "Surely you don't mean me." Now the thing about betrayal is you can't really be betrayed by someone who's your enemy or just an acquaintance. Because betrayal first requires trust. Betrayal requires trust. And in Shakespeare's play Julius Caesar, enacted here by these Lego men, the famous line, "Et tu, Brute," means "even you, Brutus?" The stab from the friend was the one that hurt the most. But what are we to make of verse 21? Jesus says, is this one of you, he replied, one who dips bread into the bowl with me. Verse 21, the Son of Man will go just as it is written. But woe to that man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born. The Son of Man is one of Jesus' titles. He uses it often to talk about himself. And presumably, Jesus had in mind a prophecy from Psalm 41, written again about 1,300 years earlier by David. Even my close friend, someone I trusted, one who shared my bread, has turned against me. Matthew tells us that Judas betrayed Jesus in return for 30 pieces of silver. Well, that was prophesied as well in Zechariah. There's a prophecy about those 30 pieces of silver. So, if it was inevitable that Judas was going to betray Jesus, how can it be his fault? How can Jesus say, woe to that man, if it's happening as it was written? In other words, as it was prophesied that it would happen, as it must happen. How can it be Judas's fault? It's a tricky question. Sometimes we tend to assume that either God is completely in control or we have freedom to choose. As if the two are equal or mutually exclusive. Like, it can't be Judas's fault if it was written, because how can he help it? That's the way the argument goes. It's a bit like these shapes here. You've got God's will on one side and human will on the other side. The shape can't be both a triangle and a circle, can it? No, we treat them like they're mutually exclusive. You can't have a triangular circle. You don't think you can. I'm sure some clever boffins made one somewhere. But what if God's will and human will are actually totally different things, like a square, a shape, and a colour? What if they're not the same sort of thing after all? Because then you can have a red square. What is all that about? It's all about categories. You see, if we put God's will and human will in the same category, then yeah, Judas wasn't to blame. Because he couldn't help himself. It was decreed from centuries earlier. But if God's will and human will are different categories, they can both be true at the same time. In other words, it can be prophesied and decreed, and also Judas's fault. His responsibility for his choice. It's quite hard to get our heads around. That analogy isn't perfect, but it sort of helps me think through the question. God's will and human will are not the same sort of thing. But actually, that's another red herring. I should have put the picture of the red herring in there as well. Because who betrayed Jesus? Well, Judas did for a start. But what about the rest of them? They all stayed loyal to the end, didn't they? They were there with Jesus in his trial? No. We'll find out in a couple of weeks' time. When Jesus was arrested, what did they do? They ran away. What did Peter do? He sort of followed on at a distance, and when he was challenged, do you know what he said? I have nothing to do with him. I don't even know who you're talking about, he said. He denied even knowing who Jesus was. Who betrayed Jesus? All of them betrayed Jesus. And that begs the question for us. We might not betray Jesus like Judas did, but perhaps we betray Jesus like the disciples did. Perhaps we make ourselves scarce when the difficult questions come, when people challenge our faith. Perhaps we speak and act as though we've never heard about Jesus. Christians are both the best advert for faith and the worst advert for faith. Because we are, God said, Jesus called us to be the light of the world, to take the light of God out from this church into the community. And when we do that, we're the best advert for God. But when we act just like everyone else, we're the worst advert for faith. That's when we betray. And that's not anyone's fault, anyone's responsibility, but ours. That's the bit in the middle of the sandwich. But thankfully, God's story doesn't end there. As a family was having dinner on Mother's Day, I know it's Mothering Sunday, but for the purposes of this joke, I'm going to call it Mother's Day. For some reason, the mother was unusually quiet. Finally, her husband asked what was wrong. "Nothing," she said. No woman's ever said that. Not buying it, he said, "Seriously though, what's wrong?" "Do you really want to know?" she said. "Well, I'll tell you. For 15 years I've cooked and cleaned and fed the kids, and it's Mother's Day and you haven't even said thank you." "Why should I?" he said. "Not once in 15 years have I received a gift on Father's Day." "Yes," she said, "but I'm actually their mother." The third R is gratitude. The controversial sentence is upon us. "This is my body," Jesus said. What did he mean by that? Well, it's possible to make too much of that little word, and it's possible to make too little out of it. Some people have pointed out that Jesus didn't speak Greek, which is what the New Testament is written in. And in Greek, did you know, you don't use the present form of the verb to be, so there was no word "is." Well, that seems to me like one of these. Jesus' body was physically present when he held the piece of bread and said, "This, my body," in Aramaic. "This, my body." Well, he was actually there. So what was he on about? And as for drinking blood, well, that was completely forbidden in the Jewish law. So he can't have been talking about that either. So what is going on? This is Jess. Except actually it isn't Jess, because she's sitting there. What this actually is, this is a picture of Jess. Here's another one. This is Amington. Except it's not Amington, is it? It's a sign. What it actually is, this is where Amington begins. On Secret Lane. This is love. Except it's not, is it? It's a ring. This is a sign of my love for my wife. We all understand those readily enough. We know what they mean. So what did Jesus mean when he said, "This is my body, this is my blood"? See, like all those other examples, the bread and the wine are signs, pointing not to themselves, but to something else. The sign is important. When it comes to the bread and wine of communion, they are very important, but they're not as important as the thing they point to. If there were no road signs, you'd never know where you were. But the road signs aren't important. The place is important. This ring is important. It's a sign of my marriage. But what's important is the actual marriage, not the ring. So what are the bread and the wine pointing to? Remember, this is a Mark and sandwich. There's the sandwich, in case you were still hungry. or not hungry yet. Maybe that'll make you more hungry. Where did we begin? Passover. We began with the Passover. And the first R was
rescue.
There we go. Rescue. Fantastic. We began with the Passover. There's the picture of the lamb with the blood on the doors. Only this time, Jesus is the sacrificial lamb. And it's his blood that rescues us, not the blood of a lamb. The Bible calls him the Lamb of God for that reason. In the original Passover, God's people were rescued from slavery from Egypt. Only this time, God's people are rescued from
wickedness,
human will, and wickedness and sin. This time, we're rescued from ourselves, from our slavery to our own sin, to our slavery to our own selfish desires, our pride, our rebellion, the ways in which, in other words, we do what the meat of the sandwich is, the way in which we betray Jesus. In the original Passover, the Israelites passed bread around saying, "This is the bread of affliction." They were identifying themselves, looking back at their ancestors, saying, "We are them." Today, we pass the bread of communion around with the words, "This is the body of Christ." Identifying ourselves as belonging to Jesus, who rescues us from slavery to sin, which leads to death. There's much more to say about the bread and the wine of Holy Communion. We are going to have another service about all that after Easter. For now, it's enough to say that receiving the bread and the wine of communion is one of the ways God has given us to identify ourselves with Jesus, to receive that rescue that he gives from sin. And so we come to land on the third R, gratitude. The Israelites gratefully look back to that day when they were rescued from slavery. Christians look back gratefully to that day when Jesus died in our place on the cross so that we might be released from slavery to sin. But we also look forwards. And that's where the secret fourth R comes in. We had rescue, responsibility, and gratitude. Anyone hazard a guess what the fourth R might be from our passage?
Redemption.
Return. Jesus said at the end, "I'm not going to drink this until I return, until I come back and drink it new in the kingdom." One day, Jesus will come back. And our rescue, our redemption will be complete. Now, we don't know when, but we know it will happen. And so, we're a little bit like the USS Enterprise. If you've ever seen Star Trek, I know there's more Trekkies out there than you're admitting. I admit it, I'm a Trekkie. That awful split infinitive, to boldly go. That's what we are called to do. Looking back to Jesus. Looking forward to Jesus. Looking out into the world. To boldly go where God is calling us. And that's why I showed that video of Lucy. Because unless we invite people, who else will? If we don't tell them, how will people know about Jesus' wonderful rescue?